WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Wednesday, May 30th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoon. The House Freedom Caucus has come out with guns blazing at Kevin McCarthy's compromise debt ceiling deal, which was unveiled Saturday and could be voted on in the House today. Here's Congressman Scott Perry discussing why it's a bad deal.
This deal that we've heard about totally fails to deliver on all of it. And if you want to get into the details, let's just start with the IRS. 87,000 new IRS agents, all the billions of dollars, $1.4 billion cut, leaving the balance to be used by the IRS immediately, starting at this moment, continuing on for the duration of this presidency. $4 trillion at least, an unlimited debt ceiling increase. Unlimited debt ceiling, and oh, by the way, puts the incoming president, whether that's Joe Biden or whether that's a Republican, having to deal with it in a lame duck session. Absolutely and completely unacceptable. Trillions and trillions of dollars in debt for crumbs, for a pittance, every single thing. Take the student debt bailout, the student loan forgiveness, Biden forgives, you pay. None of that changes. Take the assault on American energy with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. All of those subsidies killing American energy, continued unbridled. The permitting reform, all it does is seeks to increase and impose more of the Green New Deal faster on the American people. The speaker himself has said on numerous occasions, the greatest threat to America is our debt, and now is the time to act. We had the time to act, and this deal fails completely. And that's why these members and others will be absolutely opposed to the deal, and we will do everything in our power to stop it.
Congressman Chip Roy echoed Perry's concerns and urged all Republicans not to vote for a piece of legislation that Democrats and neocons support.
Unfortunately, last week, there was a breach. There was a breach in the structure that we agreed to put in place to make sure that we are representing the American people through this heretofore United Republican Conference. The Republican Conference right now has been torn asunder. And we are working hard to try to put it back together again this weekend by making sure that this bill gets stopped. I want to be very clear. Not one Republican should vote for this deal.
Yes.
Not one. If you're out there watching this, every one of my colleagues, be very clear. Not one Republican should vote for this deal. It is a bad deal. No one sent us here to borrow an additional $4 trillion to get absolutely nothing in return. But at best, if I'm being really generous, a spending freeze for a couple of years. That's it. That's about what you get. And frankly, you're going to make things worse. And my Democratic colleagues know it. That's why they're supporting it. That's why they're going around gleeful. Look, there's a reason our Democrat colleagues support this. There's a reason that Mitt Romney supports this. There's a reason that Bill Kristol supports this. It's all the same stuff. There's a reason that our conservative allies are opposing it roundly. The Club for Growth, scoring against it. The Heritage Foundation, scoring against it. Freedom Works, scoring against it. Ron DeSantis, publicly opposed. President Trump said he thought we should default rather than pursue this kind of lunacy.
Congresswoman Lauren Boebert of Colorado contrasted the bill passed by the House GOP in April with the McCarthy-Biden deal.
The bill passed by House Republicans provided a modest $1.5 trillion increase to the debt ceiling in exchange for enacting pro-policies and real spending cuts. Our bill saved taxpayers $4.8 trillion and included real reforms. We had substantive policy included in the Limit, Save, Grow bill. We had a real opportunity to significantly cut federal spending, restore some fiscal sanity to Washington, D.C., and get our economy back on track. Unfortunately, the bill we are considering tomorrow does none of these things and is more Washington gimmicks from the swamp that kicks the proverbial can down the road. Tomorrow's bill hands Biden a blank check as it doesn't actually set a debt limit.
And while he's being accused by his right flank of caving to the Democrats over the debt ceiling, Kevin McCarthy is talking tough about FBI Director Christopher Wray for his refusal to turn over an unclassified internal document subpoenaed by House investigators. The document allegedly provides details of Joe Biden's involvement in an international bribery for political favor scheme. McCarthy warned of severe consequences if the document wasn't turned over to Congress by May 31st, today.
Comer subpoenaed the document that he's requested. We have jurisdiction over the FBI, which they seem to act like we do not. I personally called Director Wray and told him he needs to send that document. Today is the deadline. So let me not just tell you, let me tell Director Christopher Wray right here, right now. If he misses the deadline today, I am prepared to move contempt charges in Congress against him. We have jurisdiction over this. He can send us that document. We have the right to look at that, Republicans and Democrats alike in that committee. And if he does not follow through with the law, we will move contempt charges against Christopher Wray and the FBI.
You know what he says,
they
Mr.
are not
Speaker?
Above the law.
As of now, the FBI has not turned over the document, and it announced that it has no plans to do so. So now contempt proceedings are likely to start in the House. So what does this mean? It isn't clear what, if anything, Congress can do to force the FBI to produce this document. If Wray is held in contempt of Congress by the full House of Representatives, the sergeant at arms of the House can arrest him. This would likely result in a very brief incarceration and a fine of not more than $100,000. The case would then be referred to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who happens to be corrupt official Matthew Graves, one of the men threatened by Marjorie Taylor Greene with impeachment for dereliction of duty. It's a safe bet that Graves and any grand jury that might be impaneled over this issue will close ranks around President Biden and thwart any further attempts to bring the document to light of day. Recent precedent suggests this will be treated as a symbolic gesture. Two high-ranking officials in the Obama administration, Attorney General Eric Holder and IRS official Lois Lerner, were both found in contempt of Congress, but no significant enforcement action was ever taken. So join me to discuss today's stories is my colleague at the New American, Executive Senior Editor, Steve Bonta. A lot going on, Steve, and I know that you've been paying attention to it up until the moment we recorded. Where do you want to start off? Start us off here.
Well, I mean, I think the most consequential story right now, Paul, is the debt limit, the debt ceiling, the bill that's emerged from that apparently is going to be voted on by the full House sometime later today. I think it's under debate even as we speak. It bears mentioning that in addition to what we saw, I mean, most of the B-roll that we showed was in opposition. People, Boebert and Chip Roy and so forth, speaking out in strong opposition. And their position is, in effect, look, what we produced back in April contemplated no more than $1.5 trillion increase in the debt ceiling, which in and of itself is a very substantial amount. But this new so-called compromise elevates that to 4 million. And then, without going over every niggling detail, I think their objections can be summed up as follows. There are really no teeth to this. And while there are clauses that say such and such shall happen and so forth and so on, that they're claiming in effect that there's no way to enforce it. Mm. And we know from experience that the Democrats and Biden are going to just ignore it the first chance they get. So they don't think that it's going to have any substantive effect. Roy's comment that the best we're going to get is a spending freeze for 2 years. Now, I would point out, and I think we mentioned this in yesterday's segment, that that's better than anything we've gotten before. And it would seem that at least one member, one congressperson on the so-called far right, the constitutional right of the GOP, would agree with that sentiment. So this would be Thomas Massie, who is one of the senior members of the people that I don't know that he's really considered a member of the Freedom Caucus officially or not. And he did support McCarthy during that whole tempestuous series of votes to determine who would be the new Speaker of the House. He likes McCarthy. And, you know, I'm inclined to respect Massey's judgment, at least in a qualified way. He's been there longer than many of these other firebrands, which is fine. Notwithstanding, his voting record is resolutely constitutional. He's probably the closest person, not only in terms of voting record, but also temperamentally to Ron Paul, right? And here's what he said. He tweeted today, "I respect opposition to the Fiscal Responsibility Act, but I am voting yes. I've been in Congress for a decade, and this is the first real bill that cuts spending. It also includes an automatic 1% cut to spending on January 1st if Congress doesn't pass the 12 appropriations bills." Now, what he means by that's the end of it. I mean, being a tweet, it's not very, it doesn't go into much detail. Yeah. What he means by this is that there is a provision that I personally kind of like from what I can find out about it, and that is that it's an attempt to put an end to this long, sordid custom of passing omnibus appropriations bills instead of parceling them out into 12 separate bills of readable, digestible length, where with amendments that can be debated and all of this, what the practice has become in effect to pass these last-minute monster appropriation bills and put them on the floor on Christmas Eve or something like that with not giving, you know, 4,000 pages or whatever. Nobody has time to look at it or even skim through it, and they're asked, you got to vote on it, because if you don't, we're going to be in a crisis, vote on it. And then we'll find out what's in it afterwards. You know?
I still can't believe that's allowed.
Yeah, it's so crazy. So apparently this new bill attempts to remedy that, and it says, in effect, if you try that, then there's going to be an across-the-board 1% cut in everything, military and non-military, as of January 1st. So that, you know, you have to like that.
Is there a way to enforce that so to make sure that happens?
Well, the enforcement is the fact that per the Constitution, all of this funding, it needs to originate in the House. Mm-hmm. All appropriations bills need to originate in the House, and if the House doesn't appropriate it, it doesn't happen. Yeah. Now, as far as enforcement, the automatic 1% cut, I mean, it would be statutory if this thing gets caught. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is significant. You know, and I kind of vacillate myself. I think that came through in yesterday's discussion and carry over into today. On the one hand, it is clear that what the Boberts and the Roys are saying is true, that this compromise represents a significant step down from what was passed in April. Okay, on the one hand. On the other hand, what Massey is saying is, yes, that's true, and I understand. I sympathize. But on the other hand, it's something that we haven't seen. And this is a claim that McCarthy's been making since Sunday, or Saturday night, I guess, when it was first announced. He said, this is the first time that there's ever been any kind of pause or cut in spending. And I think he's correct in so saying. And in particular, you know, in credit to McCarthy, he has said also that you know, that when Congress has been in power of both houses in the White House, all they ever do is talk the talk, and then when it comes down to
Republicans,
yes, talk the talk, and then when it comes down to crunch time and the full media blitzes on, oh, you know, you're going to bankrupt the country, then they always cave. And so what he's saying is, this is the first time we haven't caved completely.
Yeah. Do you think that's
a partial cave, maybe?
Are Democrats going along with this because they realize that this pack of Republicans is determined to really stick or try to stick to their guns? If they're getting some cuts, that's better than they wanted to get. Weren't they months ago? They were saying there would be nothing, no cuts. They weren't even agreeing to go back to pre-COVID levels, right?
Right. No cuts, no conditions of any kind, and all this sort of thing. So, I mean, in that sense, I guess you could couch it as a win. Again, I mean, these are hard words to say, but you don't take the massive ship of state and turn it 180 degrees like that. It takes time to, I thought you capsize the ship. So, and so it takes time, sustained effort, commitment, principled commitment, I should say. And so what McCarthy is saying, and you know, I mean, this is the beginning of a process.
Yeah. What is your thought on, because between McCarthy and Massey, these are folks who've been in there for a while versus, you know, Boebert, Chip Roy, they've been there less. Are they ideologues who don't realize, you know, how the game is played?
No, I think that that they're needed. Yeah. I mean, you have ideally you want to have the firebrands who are really pushing the envelope and saying we have to do this.
Yeah.
And then a few sober minds saying yes, but here are the pragmatic realities. We need to slow down a little bit. This is exactly what happened at the time of the American founding with the framing of the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, you had the anti-federalists versus the federalists, and the synthesis of the two resulted in, we believe,
the
best possible outcome. Sure. Yeah.
Thanks, Steve. And stay tuned, folks, because after this, we'll be discussing bomb threats that trans terrorists made against Target stores for pulling some of their perverse LGBTQ merchandise, and a case of a nuclear power plant that was so efficient producers couldn't make money. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Here at The New American, we are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org to get your tickets. And now to the rest of our stories. Police evacuated four Target stores in Utah last week after local news stations received emails with bomb threats. The CBS affiliate in Layton reported that the emails referenced Target's infamous Pride merchandise, which angered rational Americans into a boycott that caused Target to lose billions in market capitalization. Target then responded by removing some items, which then triggered the mentally ill who support grooming children with LGBTQ ideologies. Layton's police sergeant said investigations have turned up no credible threats, but prosecutors may seek subpoenas to find out who is behind these crimes. Meanwhile, four other store locations in Ohio and one near Philadelphia also received bomb threats last week. Each store was evacuated, but Cleveland 19 News published an email containing those threats. It made clear that the source was not Target boycotters. Here's what it said. Quote, Target is full of cowards who turned their back on the LGBT community and decided to cater to the homophobic, right-wing, redneck bigots who protested and vandalized their store. End quote. After naming the locations where bombs had supposedly been placed, the email went on to say, we will continue to bomb your targets until you stop cowering and bring back your LGBT merchandise, end quote. Each threat turned out to be a hoax. What is true is that customers nationwide are boycotting Target, regardless of whether stores have pulled their perverse product lines. What's the result so far?
Target. I mean, this Target boycott is actually working. They lost $10 billion in 10 days. That hurts.
And when market prices for electricity plunged in Finland, the country's newest nuclear power facility significantly cut back production. OL3 is the first nuclear reactor built in Finland in 40 years. It reached criticality in April and overloaded with electricity, an area that had been crippled by lack of Russian exports since it had invaded Ukraine. Finnish news outlet Wiley reported that the increased amount of nuclear generation, combined with extra hydropower, briefly forced the market price for electricity below 0 cents per kilowatt hour and kept it hovering barely above that for some time afterward. In response, the reactor's owner and operator, power company TVO, scaled back production so it would not have to pay for unused electricity that it produced. This prompted two observations by Zero Hedge. The first is that the Finnish example is a testament to how nuclear can play a part in solving the current energy crisis. Zero Hedge also called the move hypocritical. When power prices were extremely high in 2022 and hurting consumers, it was all Russia's fault. But now that prices are plummeting, operators can't have that, so they withdrew supply to hurt consumers. This seems to illustrate a simple economics 101 case of supply exceeding demand and an example of greedy capitalists exploiting consumers. But is that a fair assessment in a country which heavily subsidizes so-called renewable energy sources? Finnish Energy reports that over 70% of investments in electricity generation in the EU region are made in subsidized renewable energy sources, and investments are made according to subsidies, not production conditions or demand. In other words, the playing field is stacked against nuclear and fossil fuels and in favor of so-called renewable sources. TVO complained about the situation back in 2015. The U.S. witnessed the disastrous effects of this setup during the devastating winter storm of 2021, which hit 25 states between the Mexican and Canadian borders. Dozens of people died in Texas, where wind turbines make up 23% of the energy portfolio. Consulting engineer Ed Hiseroff explained that Texas wind is so overly subsidized that nuclear and fossil fuels have to routinely back out of their efficiency range in order to avoid paying for the unused power they produce. When the turbines froze during the winter storm, it took time and a lot of energy to bring the reliable producers back online, and many people perished as a result. Well, Steve, Is nuclear power too efficient for capitalism?
Well,
isn't that an interesting case?
No, I mean nuclear power, by which we mean power from fission breeder reactors, this type of thing. We're not talking about fusion. That's a different story, but we talked about that the other day.
Yeah, we did.
But traditional nuclear power is hands down the most efficient means of producing energy ever devised. And if its full potential were permitted by government bureaucrats and left-wing politicians to be unlocked, it would be an unalloyed boon benefit to the human race. Unfortunately, the left has been in a crusade against nuclear power from the beginning, claiming that that safety matters far outweigh any conceivable benefits. This is part and parcel of, the left is always instinctively opposed to anything that improves the human condition via progress. Sure, the left, the proto-left was, what we used to call the Luddites, opposed the Industrial Revolution. And they've opposed steadfastly and consistently the march of technology ever since. Now, when I was a boy, I lived in West Central Pennsylvania, about 100 miles from the Three Mile Island power plant. And I remember well when I was, I believe in the ninth grade, we had a chemistry teacher who talked about nuclear power and was very much in favor of it because I think he had at least a master's in chemistry and he was trained as a scientist. And he said, nuclear power is safe. And certainly in comparison to other forms of energy, it's far less contaminating and all the rest of this. And then in the middle of the school year, all of a sudden, the Three Mile Island crisis hit. There was a partial meltdown of the reactor, and in conjunction with that, a popular movie called The China Syndrome, featuring good old Hanoi Jane Fonda, appeared a few months later, in which the dialogue, which everyone swears was written before Three Mile Island ever happened, there's a line in there where they're saying if there were ever, a core reactor meltdown, it could devastate an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania. And apparently, I never saw the movie, but my parents did, and they said there was this frisson of nervous laughter in the audience when they made that statement. Oh, what a coincidence this is. So I don't know, but this confluence—
Sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Well, almost. But this confluence of events back in the late 1970s, the Three Mile Island and obviously the China Syndrome, which is a masterful piece of neo-Luddite propaganda—
And this was after Chernobyl a few years
ago. No. Chernobyl was later. And, of course, Chernobyl was really the nail in the coffin. That was in 1985. Hmm. Or 1986, I believe. Yeah. And so that was later than, of course, more recently we had the Fukushima meltdown because of the big 2012 tsunami in Japan. Or what was it, 2015? 2015. Anyway, the recent, mega tsunami that devastated Japan. Okay. So as a result of this, the public perception has more or less acquiesced to what the left has been insisting. And nothing could be farther from the truth. There have been plenty of conventional power plants and industrial, factory accidents and so forth that have lamentably resulted. Injuries happen. Yeah. This is what happens when technology advances. Mistakes are sometimes made. Mm-hmm. But the benefits of nuclear power so far outweigh, and the Europeans are finding this now. The Europeans, we've wondered for decades, how can the Europeans have so much socialism And yet their economies continue to prosper. Well, a big part of the reason is that until recently, countries like France and Germany in particular, you know, and the Netherlands have relied heavily on nuclear power and have sort of brushed aside this whole thing.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have that, you know, sort of weighing them down. Whereas in the United States, we only recently, I think, commissioned the first nuclear power plant in like 40 plus years.
Yeah. We, you know, one thing we cut out of that was that was the opposite of what you should not be doing. An example, Germany is doing the opposite of what Finland is doing.
Absolutely.
And German citizens are paying through the nose for electricity. If only they'd come around. We also played out, was it a couple weeks ago, where we showed the TED Talk from Michael Schellenberger, the reporter, who was making the case, you know, an environmentalist, and, you know, he was all into renewable, and he realized that renewables do all the things that supposedly they don't do. They kill animals, they pollute the environment, and of course, being in California, they increase the price of electricity.
Well, some environmentalists are coming around because now they're realizing that these idiotic wind turbines that have become all the rage, and yeah. That's a whole different—
Are killing endangered birds.
Well, they're slicing and dicing golden eagles right and left in the Allegheny Ridges in the east where I come from, for instance. So now I've actually heard some credentialed leftist environmentalists say, well, you know, nuclear power, I used to oppose it, but now seeing how these wind turbines act, you know, it's definitely the lesser of two evils. And also it doesn't pollute, it doesn't create global warming the way carbon emissions does and all this stuff. So in a perverse way, the left is coming around to nuclear power.
Well, at least the principled ones. So that's a good sign, right? It sounds like we can work together. Well, thanks, Steve. We're out of time. And that's it for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because after this, I'll be talking to investigative journalist William Jasper about the treachery of Henry Kissinger. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for The New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son Noah did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack, and because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon's national security advisor and devoted globalist, has turned 100. During last week's interview with William Bill F. Jasper, we mentioned how Kissinger attended the most recent Bilderberg meeting. This time, we're taking a deeper look at one of the most destructive and effective globalists. The New American Magazine recently published an article by Mr. Jasper titled, Kissinger at 100, More Than Half a Century of Treachery, Betrayal, and Treason. Mr. Jasper is joining me to discuss this article. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Paul. Pleasure being back.
Bill, you have packed so much treachery into these four pages that we're only going to have time for a footnoted version here. So
Maybe we should just start with China. Your article makes clear that Kissinger had a pretty big role, if not the largest of any globalist, it looks like, in creating the China monster that we have today. Can you go into that a little bit and explain how one man could have such an impact and what he did? A few examples of that.
Well, yes, he is one man, and he is more important than just about any other. I mean, all of the high and mighty of the world look to him as the Oracle of Delphi, and one of his guttural, gravelly voiced utterances are looked at as great pearls of wisdom. But one of his most signal achievements should go down in history as one of the worst things to happen, not only to America, but the world. And that is the so-called opening up of China, which he initiated with his 1971 secret trip to China, where he met with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, the communist dictator of mass murderers of the People's Republic of China. And he did that ostensibly at the behest of President Richard Nixon, who he was serving at that time as National Security Advisor, head of the National Security Council, and then later as Secretary of State. But truly, he was working for David and Nelson Rockefeller, whom he had been working for years before he came on Nixon's staff. And it was David Rockefeller who then followed up his visit with his own visit. David Rockefeller, at that time being chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, one of the most important banks in the world. And of course, today it's JP Morgan Chase. But also he was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he went to China, met with Mao Zedong, and began this whole move to transform China from, at that time, a hopelessly backward, communist, totalitarian, mass-murdering third-world country. I mean, they didn't have any industry. They were hopelessly behind on everything, and transformed them with massive transfers of technology and capital and manufacturing bases, whole factories from the United States and other countries, but principally from the United States. And in the course of a generation, transformed China. They said this was going to make them more democratic, more humane, more willing to join the company of nations, and that this was going to be also a good way to play China against the other communist country power, Russia. And so this was going to be a win-win for us in China. And of course, it has turned into a disaster, as we said it would, as anyone with common sense and any understanding of who Kissinger was at that time and who he represented would have known. And here we are today with China completely at war with us. People keep saying we're going to be at war with China in a few years as they improve militarily. No, we're already at war with. We have been for decades. And just most recently, we have been at war with their bioweapon, the Wuhan flu, and with their biochemical weapon, fentanyl, which they are pouring here into the United States with devastating results. And that's only two of the asymmetric warfare schemes that they're using against us today.
Bill, in your article, you also detail, or you write about how Kissinger has personally benefited from his dealings with China. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so Henry Kissinger has benefited enormously financially from his contacts, arrangements in relationships with China. He's a multi-millionaire, perhaps even a billionaire by now. His client list includes many of the top Fortune 500 companies that do business, particularly those that do business in China. Many of the top banks and financial institutions. He brokers so many of the deals. He's the best known face in China throughout. And China news agencies, Xinhua and China Daily, et cetera, are always praising him because of his close relationship with Xi Jinping and going clear back to Mao Zedong. So, but as you pointed out in the article, it came out during the confirmation hearings for him as Secretary of State that he had received quite large, in fact, it caused some problems with his confirmation, quite large contributions from Nelson Rockefeller, who was his main patron. Nelson Rockefeller being, of course, one of the scions of the Rockefeller dynasty, the older brother of David Rockefeller of the Chase Manhattan Bank, and a former governor of New York, and a very ambitious man who tried three times in the 1960s to become president of the United States himself. And so he had very good connections with Wall Street and then with Beijing, having gone there and set up all of the arrangements to come here. Now, one of the other things that came out showing, you know, following Mao Zedong, we had Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping was supposedly the great reformer who was going to open up China to economic reform. What it really meant was Deng Xiaoping was using socialism with Chinese characteristics. So he was going to just transform the Maoist hardcore communist into a communist regime that would use all of the capitalist assets that they could get from them. But what the reformer image kind of got tarnished in 1989 with the Tiananmen Square massacre, where Deng had the military come in and just simply have tanks roll over and murder thousands of students at Tiananmen Square. And Henry Kissinger, the Oracle, was asked on ABC News by Peter Jennings, so should we be having penalties or sanctions on China as a result of this? And Kissinger responded, as expected, no, I wouldn't call for sanctions on this. The Wall Street Journal pointed out shortly after this that that Henry Kissinger, at the time that Tiananmen Square happened, and when he said, no, everything is going to be fine, Kissinger had hundreds of thousands of dollars at play in contracts that he had with Deng Xiaoping's regime at that time. And of course, those hundreds of thousands of dollars have now mounted into many.
So I guess it's kind of he's like the original Biden family as far as his dealings.
Yes, I mean, Biden would not be having the deals that he has now with Beijing absent Henry Kissinger's influence.
Yeah.
Henry Kissinger is usually associated with the Republican Party because he served under Nixon. Richard Nixon, but he really has been throughout his entire life really associated personally with far left Democrats.
Yeah. You mentioned that. I want to also get to his role in the Watergate scandal. That's something new I learned. I totally forgot. Can you go into that a little bit about Kissinger's role in the Watergate scandal?
Yes, very important. I mean, this was a huge coup, palace coup, during the Nixon administration. And so in his books and in his interviews, Henry Kissinger shows a side of himself that is really emblematic of him as an individual. He can knife someone in the back while pretending to be their friend, and even afterwards speaks wonderfully of them, much like you would see a godfather in a mafia movie doing. So he was asked by Richard Nixon to be his national security advisor because all of the public policy establishment, Council on Foreign Relations, one that said that Kissinger is the go-to guy. So he put him on as his national security advisor. In 1971, shortly after a couple of years after he was in office, Kissinger and Nixon reformulated the National Security Intelligence Division and National Security Council, and basically put all intelligence under Henry Kissinger's control. And his top guy at the CIA was fellow Council on Foreign Relations member and buddy of Kissinger, Richard Helms. So when we looked at Watergate, what you see is that what was the key issue that got Nixon in trouble? It was the formation of the Plumbers. The Plumbers were the burglary group that were going to go into the Watergate headquarters of the Democrats and get information from them illegally. And that's what was used to drive him from office. Who was it that set up the Plumbers? It wasn't Nixon, for a second. It was Kissinger and Rockefeller who were behind setting up the Plumbers. And Kissinger being in charge of the CIA, he put some of the CIA people in there to make sure that the Plumbers' burglary effort would be caught and that then they'd be able to use that to against Nixon and get him out of office. They had already gotten his vice president, Spiro Agnew, out of office with cooked up corruption charges. And so Agnew had been removed as vice president. Nixon had to appoint somebody, and he appointed Representative Gerald Ford. And Gerald Ford was a buddy also of the Rockefellers. And so when Nixon was driven from office, Ford moved up to presidency in the White House, and he appointed Nelson Rockefeller, who had been coveting the White House basically all his adult life. And so through that musical chairs, which had been carefully orchestrated, Rockefeller was finally put within a heartbeat or a resignation by Gerald Ford of the presidency. And yeah, it almost happened.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you just mentioned the CIA. In your article, you do you talk about Kissinger's role as far as in intelligence communities, and it's quite vast. Can you kind of go into what skullduggery we have as far as in the intelligence community that we can thank Mr. Kissinger for?
Well, yes. So in the past several years, particularly from 2020 on the 2020 election with the Hunter Biden laptop and the letter by the 51 former intelligence community professionals coming out claiming that this was Russian disinformation, we got a very good look into the intelligence community and how it has been corrupted. There are hundreds of thousands of agents within the various intelligence agencies, and many of them, if not most, are hardworking, patriotic Americans who are trying to protect this country. But we all know at the top levels, those are all political appointees. And so we have the James Clappers, the James Comeys, the John Brennans, all of the people that the Robert Mueller's who came to the fore during during the Trump administration. We saw them constantly trying to undermine the president and now covering for Joe Biden. Well, that was really set up in a big way by Kissinger during his time in there, where he populated the entire intelligence community with his globalist comrades, particularly Council on Foreign Relations members. Now, as we pointed out in our cover stories on the CIA and OSS and whatnot, that actually preceded Kissinger. That goes back to World War II. But Kissinger really amplified that and helped to bring it along to where we see today that the intelligence community has become, in large respect, one of the principal enemies of the American people, not the protector of.
Yeah, yeah. And you said he was also, I mean, in one of his positions, he was responsible for what information the president got as well, right? I mean, he was that instrumental.
Right. So all of the intelligence information, this was pretty much unprecedented. And since then, we haven't seen this kind of personal control over all the intelligence by a single individual. And then when he was made Secretary of State, also, he had... He had the first person ever to have both the National Security Council, National Security Advisor, and Secretary of State titles at the same time.
Yeah, that was pretty pretty significant there. Well, there's a whole lot more that we can cover, but we've run out of time. But we do recommend that you read Kissinger at 100, More Than Half a Century of Treachery, Betrayal, and Treason. You can find it at thenewamerican.com. Bill, thank you for putting this together. And like I said, I don't know how you fit so much. I mean, there's bullet points and everything, and I take it every bullet point could be its own story, and you've probably already written it. So we highly recommend this, and we thank you so much for your work, and we will see you next week, Mr. Bill Jasper.
You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Being informed is important, but being informed with the truth is essential. Visit thenewamerican.com for news you can trust.
To complete today's program, we go to the New American Steve Bonta and Gary Benoit for another installment in their ongoing series on principles. Today's principle: the most important purpose of government is the protection of God-given rights. Watch.
This is Gary Benoit, and today I'm with Steve Bonta, the executive senior editor for the New American Magazine. Steve, welcome once again for another episode to look at fundamental principles.
Hi, Gary. Good to be here.
Well, great. Now, today's principle is the fact that the most important function of government is to protect God-given unalienable rights.
Yes, and that's, of course, in those familiar words in the Declaration of Independence, isn't it?
Right.
That to secure those rights, governments were instituted among men, right? To,
yep.
To secure means to protect. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? I mean, that sort of runs counter to a lot of people's intuition, because we look at government, we see that it has this kind of coercive dimension, and then we think, well, the purpose of government is to punish people, mm-hmm. or the purpose of government is to maintain order. You know, or this type of thing. The purpose of government is to compel obedience to the laws, or however you want to put it. And, you know, to some extent, all of those things are emergent characteristics of government. Even good government, you know,
right.
has to have the ability to coerce.
It has to have an element of
force. Because there are always certain refractory souls mm-hmm. who are, here, I think, almost irredeemably criminal mm-hmm. that understand nothing but force. And so, I mean, that's an unfortunate fact about human nature. But leaving that aside, I think, you know, John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and all the other major theoreticians that laid the groundwork for what became, you know, this wonderful, you know, American... It's called an experiment. I kind of hate that term too, but this wonderful American Republic and its founding saw government at essence and in the first instance as the way to protect God-given rights,
mm-hmm.
which begs the question, why do they need protecting? Well, this is sort of, look at the world around you and imagine with Locke, okay, a time... when we didn't have all this modern technology and all this modern connectedness and everything, and people lived more or less atomistically, at least this is sort of thought experiment mm-hmm. that Locke proposed, you know, in very small units, in, you know, family units or individually or whatever. And under such circumstances, they're very vulnerable to predation from other humans, obviously wild animals as well, but also, you know, the elements, all the rest mm-hmm. of this. Not that that's quite as important when we're talking about rights, but... certain fundamental rights include the right of life and the right to develop property.
Sure. Well, three of them were listed in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, interestingly, you know, the right to property, so styled, is not mentioned in those words.
Not specifically, right.
You know, I mean, Locke says, you know, life, liberty, property, these are man,
right.
or something like that. But the Declaration says
among these rights, so it wasn't intended to be a complete list, but I wonder if you could see property as falling under the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, sure. Well, so let's take an example. So mm-hmm. so caveman Gary, mm-hmm. who lives all by himself, he has no modern technology, tens of thousands of years ago or 6,000 years ago, whatever, okay. You know, he's living out in the middle of nowhere, nothing but glaciers and woolly mammoths running around, and builds his own shelter, and he works really hard, and he, you know, and because of his work, he lays up a lot of meat for the wintertime. He grows crops. He's in good shape. He has a nice, snug dwelling that he's expended a lot of energy in building. And Locke would say that as a result of his choices and his labor, those things are his by right.
Right.
Meanwhile, caveman Steve, who's lazy, shiftless, and basically inclined to criminal behavior,
yeah, obviously
comes along.
Steve.
Yeah. No. This comes along, and because the one thing he has that Gary doesn't have is a really, really big club, mm-hmm. and so he comes along. He clubs Gary, takes his stuff, and it's over. Okay. So what does Gary do? He didn't kill Gary. He just knocked him out. So okay, when Gary comes to, he says, "I'm not going to let that happen again." So he goes out and he finds a bunch of people in the next valley, and they get together and they say, "Look, you know, this caveman Steve and the gang of hoodlums that he's with, we can't allow him to continue to take our stuff because, well, we're going to starve." So they agree to create a government whose fundamental purpose is protection.
Right.
I mean, security. I mean, we kind of, the word security now, when you think of it, we think of, oh, you know, government's always promising security and that's a bad thing. But in a sense, you know, we do all want security in the good sense. We want to be able to know that we can pursue the most worthwhile things in life, whether they be hobbies and interests, whether they mm-hmm. be our families and our communities, our churches, all these things without fear of being killed and terrorized, like the monks at Lindisfarne when the Vikings came to call, this sort of thing. We want to think that we don't have that. We don't need to worry about that. So government then becomes a solution for that. So Gary and his friends set up a big society, and the next time caveman Steve comes along with his friends, they fight them off, and that's the end of the problem. Okay, but in course of time, you know, Gary discovers, you know, he's got like 50 people together and they have this nice community, and there's a couple people in the community who are real bad eggs and they're causing problems for everyone else. So it turns out that then government becomes a mechanism to restrain criminality from right. within as well as depredation from without. So that's what we mean right. when we say protecting rights. Now,
yep.
In exchange for that, Gary and his friends say, well, you know, if we're going to hire a few people to be leaders, if we're going to elect them as leaders or appoint them as policemen or soldiers or sheriffs or whatever, you know, it's reasonable. We'll all pool together, give them some compensation for that. But the assumption will be then that they will have the resources to do what they need to do. And if at any point they get out of line, we will end their tenure and appoint somebody else. You know, so Gary and his friends remain in charge of the government that they've created. But that government becomes a blessing because then that means now Gary doesn't have to worry about fighting all the time. He's appointed somebody else.
Well, they can't forget about the government either, because if you do, it could very quickly
become
a nightmare rather than a blessing.
Sure, it's a very delicate thing, you know. But now, mm-hmm. but now Gary knows if he has a dispute with his neighbor mm-hmm. over where the boundary between their property is, well, they can appeal to a third party, the government, to come in and adjudicate the dispute. So all these things, in theory at least, will accrue as unalloyed social blessings as a result of good government. All right. And all of them, all these things really are sort of what we would call negative powers. In other words, the power to safeguard rights, not the positive power to say, okay, Gary, you know what? You're making too much money compared to these other people. So we're going to take some of your money and property from you and give it to somebody else right. so that we have this mythical thing called equality. Right. At that point, government is no longer protecting Gary's rights. It's actually violating Gary's rights in the name of this chimera, you know, which is social justice. We use this term, right? So, and that's very different from justice, by the way, without the social in front of it. Social justice is a perversion of the idea of government, because it says that it's not just the purpose of government to safeguard individual rights, but to engineer society as well. To look at society and say, well, it's just monumentally unfair that this guy has more property than that guy, or that, you know, even though inequality is the lot of human beings. When we say men are created equal, we mean in the eyes of God, but we're certainly not equal in any other way, right? We have different talents, different physical, mental, and other gifts, right? Mm-hmm. And it's that diversity of talents, that inequality that obtains, that allows us to have a society in the first place, thank goodness not everyone is like me or like you. We'd never get highways built or all the practical, sure. You know, everybody would be sitting around talking about political principles all the time. And while that's an enlightening thing to do, it doesn't get, you know, the bridges built and the crops harvested. So people have different talents and properly applied. This is a good thing. But when people start thinking along these lines of social justice, they, as Bastiat long ago observed, they turn government into an institution of plunder. Or spoliation, as he put it in French, right?
Or legalized plunder.
Legalized plunder, right. So we pervert the law, right. And by so doing, we pervert the entire purpose of government and lose sight of this really very simple, pristine fact that while government may occasionally be justified in doing other things, you know, maybe, you know, building a bridge or authorizing building a bridge across the commons or something like that, you know, certainly there are other purposes to government that are contemplated in the Constitution's preamble that we may get to at some point. But that originary purpose is a negative function of safeguarding individual rights and liberty. The idea being that to maximize societal benefit, to truly promote social justice, all you need to do is maximize individual liberty. And by so doing, you maximize individual potential. And that redounds to everybody's benefit, because now that means that Gary and Steve and anyone else who's not irredeemably criminal, right, can make choices according to their own judgment, their own talents, can develop their God-given talents for the betterment not just of themselves and their family, but society as a whole. And that's why the United States, whose government in its original form probably most closely approximated this ideal, correspondingly became the most successful state in American history and remains so.
Well, Americans could fulfill their dreams. They could pursue happiness, and they could apply their ingenuity and do all kinds of things that brought about all the material wealth that we've had because the Constitution and the form of government we had kept bureaucrats out of the way. And kept criminals out of the way, and kept foreign powers, foreign adversaries out of the way, so that all this energy could be focused on pursuing one's dreams.
Right, and you're seeing that this formula is now being applied in other parts of the world, places like, you know, Taiwan and Switzerland and Japan and many other countries that have just blossomed as a result of instituting this principle that government should be primarily about protecting individual rights.
Right. Well, thank you, Steve.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And don't forget to visit betterwayconference.org to get tickets to this wonderful event, which is another reminder that freedom lovers around the world are coming together and demanding a better way. In the meantime, visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news, and we will see you tomorrow. Have a good day.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.